did Shlishi last year. There's a lot in common between Shlishi and Revi of Kisisa. So last year I read to you a quote from Rav Shamshon Rafael Hirsch, which I'm going to read again because it is relevant to both Shlishi and Revi together. So it's a very powerful statement of the content of the third and fourth Aliyos of Kisisa. We read from Kisisa this morning. There is a very strong theological content in the middle of this week's parsha. In addition to the very dramatic episode of the Chet HaEgel, but the aftermath, the whole dialogue between Moshe and Akadosh Baruch Hu, is really unbelievably complex and unbelievably powerful and touches upon the deepest themes of our religious concerns. So there's an introduction here, which I read from last year, which just worth repeating. Just if I find the page, it's worth repeating. Sorry, let's take another second. It is... here it is. So this is worth keeping in mind about these Aliyahs, about Shlishi and Revi. Whoever said this from the English translation of Rav Shamshon Rafael Hirsch's commentary to the Chumash, says, whoever sets out to translate and explain the contents of verses 12 to 13 of Perek Lamed Gimel, it's Shlishi and Revi, must tread more carefully than at any other section of the Torah. For here we are led to the extreme limit of man's knowledge of God. The area that lies beyond this limit is intimated to us so that we should know that we cannot grasp it with the measure of knowledge granted to us for our life on earth. How then, in our attempt to understand and interpret these passages, can we not be filled with trepidation, lest we overshoot the mark of truth and stray from the straight path? Hence, we shall attempt to render only the plain meaning of the text according to the context. So he goes Kedarko Bekodesh in interpreting the Aliyah in that sense. But it's a worthwhile warning to be aware of, that this dialogue takes place on many different levels, and we don't really understand what's going on. The Gemara, particularly in the first parak of Maseches Brachos on Daf Zayin, has some discussion about what exactly is going on here. And it has to do with, at least on some level, Moshe asking HaKadosh Baruch Hu to tell him what's really the secret of the world. How exactly does he operate, primarily as the Gemara understands it? We discussed this last year in the context of Shlishi. Why is it that Tzadik Varolo and Rasha V'Tovlo, why is it that we can't really see how the world is fair? It doesn't necessarily make sense to us. So continuing that conversation here in V, God tells Moshe that he has found chen with him, that Moshe has succeeded in getting God's grace, and therefore he's going to tell him something, not clear how much. It says, Vayomer Hashem Moshe gamas adavar hazeh asher dibarte eseh ki matzasa chen beinai ve'eda acha b'shein. So I know you directly, and you have found grace in my eyes, you have found chen in my eyes, and therefore I will do that which you ask for. So what exactly that means is not totally clear. He's not giving him everything he asks for, as we understand. Rashi understands that this is a reference to Moshe's request that God's Shekhinah should rest purely on the Jewish people, exclusively on the Jewish people. And some of the commentaries explain that Moshe was concerned that HaKadosh Baruch Hu's message can get molded and shifted based on the agendas, that the Ummah Sa'olam, if they see a little bit of God's message, of God's presence, so then they take that and they change it to fit their own agenda. And that was a source of pain to Moshe, and Moshe was asking that it should go exclusively on the Jewish people. And so Rashi suggested that was granted. There's an interesting discussion in some Svarim, so how exactly do you understand Bilam's Nevuah? After this point, Bilam's Nevuah seem to be of a different nature. Maybe that's not the type of Hashras HaShchinah Moshe was talking about. There is a lot of analysis along those lines. But the dominant phrase that we find here is what's in the next pasuk, is Moshe asks, Vayomar hareini na es kvodecha. So he asks the Kadosh Baruch Hu, you should show me your honor. You should show me your glory. So what exactly is that about? What's exactly the nature of the request? And why is he asking that now? So they're at a relatively low point in terms of the relationship between God and the Jewish people. Between God and Moshe, perhaps it's different. But this is, again, the aftermath of the Chet HaEgel. It was a hard sell to get Mechila for the Jews. So he goes from that and says, now tell me your ways and show me your glory. Let me see you. It sounds like he's asking from the next pasuk. So what exactly is going on? The Aznayim Latorah, the Lutzke Rav, comments over here that he's trying to be Melamed Zchus on the Jews, that this was a part of his effort to try to connect to what went wrong. That here the Jews, they created the Egel Hazav because they were so accustomed to a visible God, not that they ever actually saw a visible God, but that they were in Mitzrayim, where that was the culture, that the gods they worshipped were visible. And it's a very big adjustment for them to try to understand that God is not that way. And here Moshe disappears on the mountain, and they're all upset, and they don't really know how to relate to this. And the Egel Hazav comes out of that, and Moshe is trying to explain that, look, they need a shtickle something. They need to be able to see something so they can understand, at least it can be something they can relate to, based on what they had been surrounded with. And maybe if you could show me something, I could go back and tell them that this is what I've seen, and I could be a shliach for that. And maybe that's perhaps what Moshe was getting at. Rav Shlomo Shnupfel Hirsch over here comments that Moshe's issue was that since, on a personal level, since he saw that this was apparently a time of chayin, a time when he was receiving God's grace. So first, in the previous aliyah, he asked, "Hodieni nas drachecha, you should show me, tell me your ways, teach me your ways, explain to me how you do things." And now he's hoping maybe for something better through the grace of God that he is receiving, that maybe he can actually perceive God. And then the understanding of how he operates will flow from that. There is a fascinating essay about this, a brief essay in the Nesiva Shalom, the Slonim Rebbe, where he understands that the purpose is essentially that, specifically because it's the aftermath of the Chet, that Moshe is asking God, okay, so the Jews have sinned, and they've been forgiven, and now we're in a tshuva phase. So his question is, how will there be a Kiddush Hashem from this? How will there be an enhancement of God's glory in the sense of tshuva me'ahava? We know that the Gemara tells us in the last parak of Yuma that tshuva can affect an erasing of the sin. Zidonos nasano kishkagos, your intentional avarice are made like they're nothing. But there's a greater level also, tshuva me'ahava, that your avarice can turn into sources of merit. So essentially Moshe is asking that, where can we find in the aftermath of this Avera how this will enhance the glory of God? Not just that we can get past this episode, but that we can learn from it, and that there can be a greater level of Kiddush Hashem that will arise from it. And he goes on to say that essentially what Moshe was asking is that perhaps the Jews are not really able, in a similar sense to what you said a few minutes ago, but different, they're not really able apparently to appreciate God behester, we approach Purim, appreciate God through the hidden places, and they need a more direct understanding of how his ways go, of what is good and what is bad, and good people should be clearly rewarded and bad people should be clearly punished. And it's not working so well that they're expected to relate to God with his face hidden. They need a greater level of exposure and a more direct ability to understand his ways. And to that, God responds, it's just not how it works. It's that the real glory of God comes through the Hester, through people confronting God, through their lack of understanding, through Tzadik V'Ra'alo, Rosh V'Tovlo. And that is the nature of this Olam Hazeh, that that's how our perception works. And as much as Moshe is suggesting, wouldn't it be better, wouldn't we have a better chance of having a faithful nation if the Jews could perceive you directly without all of your hidden face? God is saying that's not how it is. That in this world you have to express things this way, that nobody can see my face and live, as he says. That's not possible. And therefore it has to be that they will continue to perceive me through Hester, through the hidden moments. Now, the Paris Yosef has a different angle here, which I guess is a little bit synergy for us because it connects to our Tzedakah sugyas, that Moshe was asking, okay, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, you are Rachmanis, you are Chesed, but people are also Chesed, so could you show me how it's different? And to that, HaKadosh Baruch Hu displays to him that humans, when they give Tzedakah, let's say, so their instinct is they'll give a lot of Tzedakah the first time somebody asks. And then if he comes back a second time, he's going to get a little bit less. And if he comes back a third time, he's going to get less and less and less as it goes on. So why is that? It's because the nature of human beings is that they are compassionate, but it's really a compassion for themselves, that they're uncomfortable seeing somebody suffer. So the first exposure to the suffering of the person, that arouses a lot of rahmanis, and they'll give something towards that. But then, as they get used to it, so it's harder to really come forward with so much generosity. It doesn't really become a continuing source of this hisorus. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu is different. HaKadosh Baruch Hu's Rachmanis is, so to speak, an objective Rachmanis, meaning that it doesn't just come from the kind of instinct that a human being has, that he's just uncomfortable seeing suffering, and that's something he can adjust to. That's not a Kadosh Baruch Hu's Rachmanis. So therefore, he comes again and again and again. And he suggests, so therefore, that's what the next pasuk says, Vayomer ani avir kol tuvi al panecha. That in a sense, I will show you all of my goodness, and you'll see my continuing goodness. It's very different than a human being's goodness, which is there stronger at the beginning and doesn't really continue. This is of a whole different kind. And that's what the rest of the pasuk means according to this interpretation. V'chanosi es asher achon, v'richamti es asher arachem. That God says, I will have compassion on who I have compassion with, I have favor on who I have favor, which we normally understand, as I'm saying, you're just not going to understand it, that I'm going to have rachmanis the way I see it, and that's the way it is. The Gemara says, the Gemara adds the words, afal pi she'eino hager, and even if he is not worthy, also a theme we've been talking about recently, right, to what extent is that a factor in how we should make our tzedakah decisions, the same kind of language. But God is saying, according to this interpretation, the Paris Yosef is suggesting that V'chanosi es asher achon, V'chanti es asher achem, that my rachmanis is on the recipient. I'm having rachmanis because he needs it, not because I just can't take watching it anymore, so if I throw a few dollars at it, I'll feel better, but because it's a genuine rachmanis, and therefore that's fundamentally different than what human beings say and what human beings engage in. There's Naim Latorah has another comment on this phrase, Ani Avir Kol Tuvi Al Panecha, that this is teaching us Derech Eretz how to respond to requests, that if somebody asks you for something and you can't provide everything, so HaKadosh Baruch Hu was modeling how the best way to respond is first you should tell what you can do. First do the part that you first convey that you're going to do as much as you can. Ani Avir Kol Tuvi Al Panecha, that's somewhat of a response. Before saying that you can't do everything, the next pasuk lo sucho l'ros es panai, and then that pasuk also continues ki lo yirani ha'adam v'chai, that nobody can see me and live. So he's also saying, listen, I can't do everything, but it's also in your best interest. I don't do everything. I can't actually provide everything that you want, but that's better. So maybe this is a lesson in Derech Eretz, that if somebody's asking you for something and you can't do everything, so first say the part that you can do. And then try to make them feel better about the part that you can't do, explain why even that's in their best interest. And that perhaps also is a lesson in terms of tzedakah. Also, we find in our Gemara, again for the synergy, a big emphasis on not only giving, but how it's given and how you try to convey the concern for the needs of the recipient. So perhaps that's also included in how that should be done. Torah Tumimah suggests that this phrase that the Gemara has, afal pi she'eino hagun, that I'll have rachmanis on whoever I have rachmanis on, even if he's not necessarily worthy. So he also comments that maybe that's the meaning of the word rachmanis. Rachmanis means that they don't deserve it. That if it was for people who deserve it, so that would be called tzedek. But here the rachmanis, so the idea that I will have rachmanis on those who don't deserve it, I will express chen, that is davka because they don't deserve it, otherwise it would be called tzedek, which again for our synergy is often noted that the idea of tzedakah, the fact that we use that word in Hebrew, tzedakah, is to convey that our taking care of those who are needy is not something that we do just because we're compassionate, it's something that we do because that is our basic expectation, that that's the way God set up the world, that people who have more are going to be expected to take care of people who have less. So the word tzedakah comes from tzedek meaning righteousness, it's justice, it's just the way things should be, as opposed to rachmanis, which is going beyond that. The Mefarshim also explained that chayin and rachmanis are different, that rachmanis means that you just have compassion for somebody, while chayin is something in between, that there's something about them that catches your eye, there's something that makes you favor this person, even though it's not purely deserving. So it's kind of in the middle. So we found that Noach, for example, the Torah tells us that Noach matzah chayin, and Chazal understand that to mean that it's not a total compliment to him. It means that he didn't really deserve to be saved from the mabul, but he had some quality, and then the Mefarshim talk about what that quality was, whether it was modesty, whether it was involvement in Torah study, it was some kind of attribute, maybe it's a mysterious attribute, some kind of a quality that makes God respond. So it's in between. So you have tzedek, which is what you deserve. You have rachmanis, which is on the other end, where a person doesn't necessarily deserve it. But you have compassion. And chayin is a reason which doesn't fully rise to actually deserving something, but somebody catches your eye, so to speak. Somebody becomes your favorite in a good sense, and therefore gets more than they would otherwise receive because of having that quality. So just to go towards the end of this brief aliyah. So basically God is saying that, and I can't really show you everything, you're going to see a little bit, but you're not going to see so much. And Vayomer Hashem, Hinei Makom Iti V'Nitzavto Al Hatzur. So God says to Moshe here, come stand with me, kind of try to see the world the way I see it, and not with my full view, but understand the nature of the perspective that you can't really understand from where you are, how the world works. And you should stand on the rock. And then the pasuk continues, Vayaba vork lodi v'samticha b'nekras atzur. So when my glory passes by, you will be sheltered in the cleft of the rock. V'sakosi kapi alecha ad avri, and I will cover you with my hand until I have passed by. And some sofer has a comment about this, others have a comment, or Soloveitchik Darshan about this, that the idea is that we simply are bound by the laws of reality, that we are not able to fully understand how all the parts come together. And the rock here, the cleft of the rock, represents that. The fact that reality blocks you off here, that there's something in your way if you're being able to fully see. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is showing to Moshe that that's what it means to be human, that you're not going to have the perspective that's going to enable you to understand fully how my ways make sense. But you should be able to at least appreciate that fact, appreciate that there's more than you can see. So the fact that your vision is obscured now that you're sheltered by this rock, that symbolizes this. That shows you that that's the nature of reality, that you're not going to be able to see everything. But to know that there's more that you can't see is itself a lesson, is itself a part of what he has to be taught. So that's essentially what this last pasuk conveys, last pasuk in the Aliyah, Vasirosi es kapi, Vareisi es acharai, ufanai lo yero. So when I take away my hand, what will you see? You'll see from behind. But from the front, you won't see. And this is how many comment that the idea is that we're not able to understand things in the moment. That, by its very nature, is beyond us. Sometimes, if we're lucky, like Moshe Rabbeinu, if we're on a certain madrega, the best we can hope for is that we'll see things after the fact. That we'll be able, with hindsight, to be able to understand how things fit in. The Aruch HaShulchan, and it's a sefer in Halacha, the Aruch HaShulchan comments that the bracha of the Haftorah, that we say, Achor lo yashuv rekam. So the Aruch HaShulchan says that's what it means, that the promise of the Nevi'im does not come back to us empty-handed. At least Achor, at least when we look back after the fact, that we can see, maybe in the moment we can't really see how things make sense, but when we look back, we can see it. The Netziv has in his drashos that that's also the idea, the promise the Gemara has in Tainus, that the Gemara tells us that Asir HaKadosh Baruch Hu lasos macholos tzaddikim, that the tzaddikim will ultimately sit in a circle. So what's the idea of sitting in a circle? Some of the Mefarshim explain it means everybody's equal in a circle, all the points are equidistant from the center. But the Netziv understands that it means that this is the next stage from here, that here we're saying you can only see things from behind. A circle, they're all facing the middle, everyone can see what's going on. So ultimately the time will come, HaKadosh Baruch Hu will show at least the tzaddikim, at least the Talmidim of Moshe Rabbeinu, will be able to see how everything fits in. The Gemara says of that same Daf and Brachas and Daf Zion, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu showed the kesher of his tefillin to Moshe Rabbeinu, whatever that means. And the Maram Shik has a drash about that, that the idea is the Kesher of Tefillin. So Tefillin tells us, it contains the mitzvah of Avos Hashem written inside of it. We have to love God. And Maram Shik writes, Maram Shik was one of the great students of the Chasam Sofer, so this is following in the path here, that this is to symbolize to us that if you want to be able to increase your love for God, to be able to appreciate what God does, so you should look behind you, right? The Kesher of your tefillin is behind you, and it's something that ties things together. So it's symbolic of the idea that after the fact, you look behind you, sometimes you can see how things are connected, and the more you look for that, the more you seek that out, the more you'll be able to have a greater appreciation of God's work in the world, and the more your Avos Hashem will increase. The Torah Tamimah has a comment along similar lines. The Torah Tamimah notes that just like when you see a kesher, you see a knot, so you know that it's connected to something else, you see that it's connected to something. So too, the kesher symbolizes that even though we don't see the whole picture, but we know that things are connected, we know that things are tied together, and that's going to give us a greater appreciation for what God does. Again, it's just like the cleft of the rock, that even though we don't necessarily see it, but we know that there's more that we don't see, and we can appreciate that. And to connect that to Purim a little bit, for the purposes of synergy and Yonadiyoma and everything else that we strive for. So Purim, we know there is this great focus that has developed, at least in the recent centuries, of laughter, of comedy, of joking around, and it's worth asking, I spoke about this Sunday morning in Kol Yom Rishon at greater length, what is the role of a sense of humor? The idea that one has the ability to laugh, so what? How does that fit into our hashgafic values? What is the place of humor within a Torah hashgafa? And it's interesting, Rav Shechter quoted from the Rav, that the Rav had a drasha, he actually gave this in a hesped, that the Gemara in the first parak of Avodah Zarah says that part of the day HaKadosh Baruch Hu spends playing with the Leviathan, playing with the big fish. So you might ask, why do I need to know that? What does that got to do with anything? How is that at all valuable for my religious beliefs? So Rav Shechter quotes from the Rav that this is valuable for halachic purposes, that we have a mitzvah of halachta bedracha. We've been talking about that all semester. That we should imitate God. So as we've been discussing, most prominently, that's a fulfillment of chesed, that we should act with chesed, with kindness, just like God does. Also, again, one of the themes of this aliyah. But the Rav expanded on this, and that any time you find an attribute of a Kadosh Baruch Hu in the Torah, in the Gemara, that it's there for halachic purposes. It's there to teach us how we should be by imitating God. So if that's the case, so what's the significance of playing with the Leviathan? Said the Rav, the point is that we should know that you can't take everything so seriously. That you can't take everything as such a big deal. You have to be able to be a little bit playful sometimes. You have to have a little bit of a sense of humor. So just to continue on that theme, what does that mean? So okay, so that still seems kind of obscure. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu has a sense of playfulness, so we should also have a sense of playfulness. What does that mean? I think what it means is that the v'alachta bedracha that you find in a sense of humor is sometimes called a sense of perspective. The idea that you can see how things fit in, that you can figure out what's a big deal and what's not such a big deal. That's really what we mean when we talk about a sense of humor in the ideal sense. And from that definition, so HaKadosh Baruch Hu has, of course, the ikar sense of perspective, the ikar ability to know how everything fits in. And the more you have that sense of perspective, the more you can lead a productive life, the more you're able to know that this is something I should pay attention to and this is something I should pay less attention to. And therefore, I can be productive and successful because I know what deserves my time and my respect and my attention and what doesn't. So it could be that a sense of humor in the idealized form is a sense of perspective. And that, of course, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, by his very nature, represents. And we're told, v'alachta bedracha, that we should try to have that in its full sense, that we should try to have a sense of perspective. But, as this aliyah reminds us, that we don't really have it fully. We don't have the ability to have complete perspective because we're not a Kadosh Baruch Hu, so we can't really see how the whole world fits in. We can be confident that there's an answer, but we don't really have the ability to fully appreciate it. So perhaps in that sense, we could appreciate and understand one line the Gemara has, which seems to be anti-humor. The Gemara of Maseches Brachos has a statement, Asur lo li adam lamalei schok piv ba'olam hazeh, that it's forbidden for a person to fill his mouth with laughter in this world. There's a whole discussion what that means practically. What does filling your mouth mean? We're talking about Mashiach, Beis HaMikdash. What exactly is going on? But the Gemara ties it to a pasuk that we all know from Shir HaMaalos. The pasuk says, "Oz yamalei tzchok pinu," that there will come a time when our mouth will fill with laughter, but not yet. We're not there yet. So perhaps what the Gemara is getting at is that we laugh because we have a sense of perspective, because we have the recognition that things are fitting into a picture where some things are more important and some things are less important. But we can't fill our mouths with laughter at this point in history because we recognize that we don't have the complete perspective. We strive to have a perspective, but we know that our perspective is incomplete. And therefore, the Gemara tells us that to fill your mouth with laughter, that would be wrong. That would be a statement that you understand more than you actually do. And we're not there yet. But the thrust of the comment is that that will change. That there will come a time when we will have more perspective. Right now, we don't understand exactly how things fit in. But someday we'll reach the wonderful world of Oz, right? Oz Yamale Schok Pinu. And then we'll understand how everything fits in. Then we'll be able to see, as the expression goes, then we'll look back and laugh. Then we'll look back and we'll see, oh, now I see how it all makes sense. So that's essentially perhaps this idea that the Aliyah is conveying to us, that right now we have to understand the limitations. But there also is a promise that ultimately there will be the ability to appreciate. And perhaps that's also what Purim represents. Purim represents the unfolding of history in a way where, looking back, we're able to appreciate. Many comment this about the Hester Panim and about Esther and about how everything that turned out to happen with Vashti and Esther, everything ended up being necessary in order for God's plan to play out. And looking back, you can see that. And I think we've also commented that in a different sense, so the Gemara tells us in Shabbos, we commented on this sometime in the past few days, that Purim is a time of Kabbalah Satorah, that we didn't receive the Torah willingly at Har Sinai, but Kimu V'Kiblu, that's why we have a Kimu V'Kiblu Kolel, that represent the fact that Purim is a time when we willingly receive the Torah. The Medrash Tanchuma in Parshas Noach tells us that at first we didn't receive the Torah so happily. That's a reference to the Torah Sheval Peh, that was too much for us. All the Diyukim and the Chumras and the Torah Sheval Peh, that we were not able to happily accept. But after Purim, in the aftermath of a great miracle, now we realize how it's all beautiful, and we're able to look back and to laugh and to appreciate that. And perhaps, therefore, that's the theme of Purim, that we should be able to try to find the beauty in all of these elements that we're not always able to appreciate initially. That's this for Isus Acharai, that looking back, even if in the moment we're not able to see it, but sometimes when we look with as big a picture as possible, as big a perspective as possible, we're able to see something very different. And in that sense, Amalek really represents the opposite. Amalek, who Chazal actually call a letz, a clown. A clown meaning, as Rav Huttner explains, in the sense of a scoffer. He's a cynic. He didn't understand how anything was really important. He didn't think that Klal Yisrael was formidable, despite the fact that they just had Kriyas Yamsuf and Yitzias Mitzrayim. He thought that was nothing. He wasn't able to get the message. And to that point, we're told that that's very dangerous. That type of cynicism, that kind of leitzonus, is not what we talk about when we mean laughter, and that we strive on Purim to get a Jewish sense of humor. That means a sense of perspective. And that doesn't mean cynicism, where one has the attitude that nothing's important. That's the meat of a Amalek, and we're looking for the opposite with our striving on Purim. Okay, so again, there's more than one could ever fully say about this Aliyah or about the previous Aliyah. It goes to the very core of our theological questions, but just a brief overview of some of the thoughts that you find. So you have a few minutes left. We'll catch Mincha in the Beis Medrash for the Tainus. But I left you with a question yesterday, so just to go back in terms of our Ksuba Sugya. So I left you with a question. If you had a chance now to see the missing Marmakomos, it wasn't clear why they were missing, but the Marmakomos that had been missing from before, you get a chance to see them a little bit more now. And so, what exactly, do you have any thoughts that, and we will have to finish this on Sunday, but at least we'll take it one step further in the few minutes that we have. So, if we saw that deception for the purpose of tzedakah does not seem to be acceptable, and certainly that means at an extreme that you can't lie about, well, a real extreme, you can't pretend something's tzedakah when it's not. That's what our Gemara explicitly is talking about. Similarly extreme, but one notch below, is to try to collect for a different cause than you're really collecting for. So you tell somebody it's cause A, which she likes, and really it's cause B, which maybe also is at tzedakah, so it's a madrega below the deception that our Gemara talks about. But we see that that's also clearly not considered to be acceptable. And if you do that, then you'd have to return the money. That's considered to be essentially defrauding the donor. So then we went to the next level below that. So let's say it's not about misrepresenting the cause. The cause is honestly represented. But the deception is in the popularity of the cause, that you make it look like you're giving, you make it look that other people are giving, when really that's not the case. So there we find also, as the Menachas Yitzchak points out in Tshuva, and he has a raya from this Gemara in Sukkah, that's also not acceptable. Because the Gemara says in Sukkah that the postgate stalker barabim, the people who make a big spiel about how much they're giving, and they have no intent to give, they're doing this just so they can say, well, at least I'll support the cause by making it look popular. So that, which happens nowadays, so it happened also in then days, so that's apparently not a legitimate approach either. But what about the Gemara in Erechin? So what impression, you saw the Gemara in Erechin now, so what impression do you have from the Gemara in Maseches Erechin? So there it sounds like Rav Yanai would do something that made it look like the kupa was less full than it was, and that was good. The Gemara suggests it was good for tzedakah. People then were motivated to give more because they had a stronger sense of urgency. It looked like it was low. So that seems a little bit deceptive. So why is that okay, if that's okay? Do you have any thoughts? That's where we left the question yesterday. Do you have any thoughts why that would be it seems like there's some degree of misleading going on. So lying, sometimes you can do with Nei HaShalom. When there's a Beis Yosef, which I think I didn't even put on the Mishnah where I'm a Kamos, but you should take a look at the Beis Yosef on this. I meant to tell you about that. The Beis Yosef asks, if Rav Yanai wanted to do this, he wanted to tell people that, he wanted to give people the impression that the tzedakah was more depleted than it was, why don't you just say it? You know, Mutar L'shanos, as we've seen. So Beis Yosef has a few answers. Maybe he didn't want to express it that way. He was happier just implying it. But it sounds like that to convey this message was acceptable. But to say that it's justified by tzedakah is difficult because, yeah, but we just had the previous three cases were not enough, right? To misrepresent the cause, even if it's a tzedakah cause, even to misrepresent the popularity of the cause, we saw it doesn't seem to be acceptable. Even though there you're being straight out, this is the cause and this is what you're actually giving it to. But to falsely create the impression that more people are giving it to it than actually are is apparently a problem. So what's the difference here? I think Menachem had a hand up before.
They have a responsibility to get tzedakah, and the way to kind of encourage them to give is by...
Oh, so that's interesting. So you're focusing specifically in that case, you're assuming there's a responsibility in that case, which is different than the other cases. So that's the way many poskim do address it. That, and we'll mention in a second, that's the way Rav Vosner and Achuva seems to take that approach, which is certainly a mahalach that we'll have to explore. We'll have to say a little bit more about this on Sunday. But I thought there's a more simple answer, that you could say that it has to do with the level of deception, that the others are higher levels of deception that are more problematic. Certainly to fake a tzedakah is very problematic. To misrepresent which tzedakah it is still getting donations under false pretenses. And then we find that even the popularity of the tzedakah also creates a level of falseness that we're not comfortable with. But here, the point is, you're not really misrepresenting anything of consequence, because the fact is, tzedakah is always an urgent need. And it happens to be that people are able to forget about that urgency because it looks like they're doing well. It looks like the pile is high. So he's saying, okay, I'll even things out. So I'll take away some of the money that's there so it will look like it's more urgent, but the fact is it is urgent anyway. So there isn't really a fundamental misrepresentation. It's really just putting things back on level playing ground. That the would have been more deceptive the other way, that people see a big pile of money and they think that, okay, the stock is fine, it doesn't need anything. And that's never true. It's always really going to need. So he was kind of evening things out by not letting people tell themselves that Staka is fine, Staka is satisfied. Hi.
Could it be also part of the focus of the Gemara is the what the Aniyim want, if it was good for the Aniyim or not,
mm-hmm.
Nichalei. So maybe in the Gemara and Sukkah, if people misrepresent, you're going to have less people donating because they're saying, oh, someone's lying. Mm-hmm. Apparently, in the case of Rabbi Yanai, that wasn't going to be the reaction. The Aniyim found that there was more money available to them.
Okay, could be. But some explain, as similar to what Menachem was saying, I think, that Rav Vosner has a shuv along these lines, that he thinks that he's not distinguishing based on what kind of deception it is, assuming that it's all the deception is all in one big basket. So it must just be that this is a different kind of case. And that this we'll have to segue to, we'll have to go to Mincha, and we'll have to speak more about this on Sunday, and then we'll go into our Chazara. But he's assuming that this is a function of Kfiya, which was going to be our last point before finishing our unit, that if Kfiya is possible, so then you can do it through misrepresentation too. That if it's a situation where you can compel someone to give tzedakah, so this is a legitimate form of compelling, which I think is what Menachem's getting at, that when the responsibility is established, so then this is considered to be legitimate, which is interesting. You then have to assume that the sheker shabo is a ben adam l'chavero. It's not a midos issue per se, but it's about how you cause somebody problems through misrepresentation. So if you're just helping them do what they have to do anyway, then maybe it's not necessarily such a problem. And that gets into the whole question of what kfiya is, and when kfiya is appropriate, and what kfiya means. So if you saw the Meiri and Daf Mem Tes, I remember at the very beginning of Zman, we spoke about this, that the Gemara says that there was some level of kfiya with staka, and Tosfos and Daf Mem Tes asks, how could it be? So, for a technical reason, which we'll get more into on Sunday. But the Meiri discusses over there on that same daf, the Meiri discusses whether it's a real kfiya, some kind of kfiya, maybe it's just verbal kfiya. So, it could be that this is perhaps understandable as a method of kfiya. But I actually prefer my approach. I think that rather say that outright deception is not going to really be acceptable. But here, it's not really deception. It's essentially leveling the playing field so that it creates the accurate perception that really is the case anyway. But I'll leave you with another thought experiment now. Somebody actually asked me the Shiloh last week, practical Shiloh, or mentioned it at least. And so tell me what you think about the following. Think about this over Purim when you're involved in Staka, so you can think about the Staka issues. And so if Torah and Staka are two of our major themes on Purim, so think about the Torah of Staka over Purim and come to me on Sunday with what you think about this. So let's say about the following. This is really going to draw on a lot of things that we spoke about this semester. It's a good midterm question. So here's your essay question. So let's say you have at Staka that every year they publish a list of their donors. And the purpose is in order to encourage other people to give. So they have a list where you have it ranked, you know, the gold donors and the platinum donors and the donors who get the yarmulkes and the silver donors and, you know, whatever it is, all the different madrigas of land. The understanding is if you're in a special category, it means you give more. So what we've clearly seen today is that it doesn't seem like one could fake being on this list just in order to inspire more people to give. But what would you say about the following? And don't answer now, think about it. That let's say somebody has for many years given at a high level to a tzedakah and has been in the gold, platinum category, whatever it is, the mega wonderful category. And this year, they're having a hard time financially. Their business is not doing well. So they ask a favor from the tzedakah. They say, I'm not going to be able to give this year, I'm not going to be able to give on that madrega, but I don't want people to know. So I'd like you to continue publishing my name in this booklet the same way. You know, whenever you advertise who the mega wonderful gold platinum donors are, so I've been there the past 5 years, put my name there also, even though this year I'm not actually giving. Is that acceptable to do?
So
So isn't that a form of tzedakah on the other side? Meaning from the fact that this person now fell on hard times. And
so you're drawing on our...
Them to their status.
So you're drawing on our day machzor. That's why I say this shayla actually draws on many different elements. It draws on what we've spoken about today, but also it draws on a lot of what we've seen about day machzor. Also it draws on some of what we've seen last semester in terms of L'shanas Me'ashalom. So it really is a good midterm essay question. But instead of asking you in that context, I'll let you think about it over Purim. And God willing, on Sunday, so we should start our Chazara on Sunday, but we'll spend a few minutes just finishing off talking about Kfiyah, and so share your thoughts about this question, and hopefully we'll find it illuminating. All right, so we have 5 minutes to get to the first floor of the main base.